This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Shane Cottadall from the Center for Constitutional Rights joins us to talk about alleged drugging of Guantanamo inmates.
We thought we'd heard enough with brutal treatment and torture of the people at Guantanamo. And now, psychotropic drugs under which people were interrogated?
We'll talk with attorney David Reams, who has been deeply involved in litigation on behalf of Guantanamo inmates.
Last week, Adnan Latif, one of David Reams' clients, became the ninth man to die at Guantanamo. Is that the only way Guantanamo will close when all 167 remaining Guantanamo detainees are dead?
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, recently the President of Bolivia, Evo Morales, announced that the U.S. government is refusing to extradite former President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada. He faces formal charges on genocide. What's happening with this?
Yes, former President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, also known as Goni, I'm not sure why, although his Spanish has such a marked American accent, because he was raised mostly here, that people would nickname him, I guess, American-type names, whatever. He is residing in the United States. But in 2003, he was the president of Bolivia. And there ensued something called the gas wars, when Goni, the former president, tried to say, we're going to export the gas of Bolivia outside of Bolivia to another country, whether it was Chile or something else, I don't recall. But the people got really upset by it, the people of Bolivia. They went into the streets, they demonstrated. Goni ordered a crackdown, and in the crackdown, 67 men, women, and children were killed, and more than 400 were injured.
And it's worth noting, these were from an impoverished indigenous community.
Right, and it's worth noting that Goni, the former president, was not part of the indigenous community, but had a long, different history in Bolivia. In any case, there's this massacre, there's a crackdown. Ultimately, the gas wars and that crackdown led to Goni's having to flee or leave Bolivia, get out of there.
And come to the U.S.
And come to the United States, and eventually paved the way for Evo Morales and the first indigenous president of Bolivia ever in history. It's the gas wars. It was a dramatic moment in Bolivia, but it also concerned a massacre. Many people, including my office, I should say, the Center for Constitutional Rights, actually brought a civil suit against Goni on behalf of the people in Bolivia.
And Bolivian prosecutors also brought charges against him.
Right, and that's why we're talking about it.
Right.
Because they brought a criminal case for crimes against humanity and genocide for these killings. And what did they do? Of course, because Goni wasn't there, they asked the United States to extradite Goni from the United States to Bolivia to stand charges.
And the question now is, why won't the U.S. cooperate with the extradition request? Our government is saying it's a matter of longstanding policy not to comment on extradition requests. But what do you think the reason is?
Well, the political reason is Goni was their best pal while he was president of Bolivia, and that was who they relied on for part of their Latin American allied strategy. And, of course, Evo Morales is a much more difficult figure for the United States. I mean, he's an indigenous president. He doesn't have the same belief in neoliberalism that Goni had. Well, that, I think, is the underlying political reason. What goes on here with former presidents who commit human rights atrocities, and it'll bring us into the Mexican case, but is that they should be held liable for these kinds of atrocities. But what they say is these are done when these people are president, and therefore they were immune from prosecution because they did them as part of their presidential function, not their private function.
Okay, now, I understand that. Is it also accurate that there are kind of two standards to be met for extradition requests to be successful? One, that the accused crime has to be a crime in both jurisdictions. And secondly, there has to be a reasonable belief that the individual committed the crime.
Yes, of course that's the case. But once there's an indictment in Bolivia, that's pretty given that there's a reasonable belief that he's involved in the crime, or at least supervised the crime, or ordered the crime, or let it happen as the president. As far as what you're calling the double criminality, of course, massacring 67 people is a crime in the United States. What's really the core of this case and the Mexican case we're going to talk about, the core is whether a president who commits serious human rights violations, whether that's Bush in the United States who committed torture, or whether it's Goni who committed a massacre in Bolivia, or whether it's the one we'll get to, Mexico, President Zedillo, who is alleged to have committed a massacre against allies of the Zapatistas in 1997 or so in Mexico. The question is, should those presidents be held liable for those kind of fundamental human rights violations? The answer to me and other human rights lawyers is absolutely, because as soon as you start engaging in what are considered fundamental human rights violations, you can no longer be cloaked with immunity because you're the president. And that's clear under all the conventions. And it was clear, and that was the key issue in the Pinochet case. Pinochet was indicted in Spain for massacres that took place in Chile, torture, killings. The argument that was raised both in the United Kingdom before the extradition order was upheld, the argument that was made was that, well, he did these things as a president, and therefore he can't be prosecuted for acts he did as a president.
Immunity.
The British courts actually rejected that based on the torture convention, which says that no one, president, king, head of state, etc., can be immune from being charged with criminality for violations of fundamental human rights. So the U.S. is just off base with the failure to honor the extradition of Goni from Bolivia. I think the words of Evo Morales, the current president of Bolivia, are great on this. And what he says was, yesterday, a document arrived from the U.S. rejecting the extradition of people who have done a lot of damage to Bolivia. And he goes on to say, the United States is a, quote, paradise of impunity and a refuge for criminals. So think about that. Not only for Goni, former president of Bolivia, but of course for many others, including
Luis Posada Carriles in Florida, for right. The Cubans.
And for former President Zedillo of Mexico, who a civil lawsuit was brought against because of massacres that took place against allies of Zapatistas.
In the late 1990s.
That lawsuit has not yet been dismissed, but the State Department weighed in and said that they think Zedillo ought to have immunity from prosecution. He's a former president. He committed these crimes as a president. But the State Department, and this is public, said, well, he should be immune for acts he committed as a president.
And Michael, I guess I just don't understand. What is the weight of our country saying he should have immunity? Why is that our decision?
It's our decision because it's in our courts.
We feel we should give shelter.
Well, it's our decision because it's in our courts. So another country may disagree with us, but Zedillo is teaching at Yale, and they're not letting him be subject to the lawsuit. Goni, the former president of Bolivia, is living in the United States. So we just rule the roost because it's our country and there's no other court to go to. So essentially, the U.S. is making those decisions. So you now have former president of Bolivia, massacre in Bolivia, no extradition. Former president of Mexico, massacre allies of the Zapatistas in the 90s, no civil suit. Bush approving torture of people and waterboarding.
And possibly worse.
Complete immunity. And then we come to the extradition case, which has not yet been filed, of Julian Assange sitting in the Ecuadorian embassy. And the U.S., of course, has not yet filed the extradition, assuming they will, and I think they will. But there's been a grand jury sitting to indict him. And his big fear, and the reason he's in that embassy, is because he's fearful that the U.S. will extradite him for exposing the very crimes that a number of these people presently living in the United States have committed. So I leave it to our listeners to decide, do we have justice and democracy in the United States?
Michael, Glenn Greenwald had something to say about this case.
There's an important article that Glenn Greenwald wrote called America's Refusal to Extradite Bolivia's Ex-President to Face Genocide Charges. You can look at that article and other Glenn Greenwald pieces in The Guardian, where he now writes a column. Heidi, for years here at Law and Disorder, we've been
covering the case of Jose Padilla. If listeners recall, he got off a plane in Chicago. He was arrested, captured, according to the United States, by the United States government military, put into a brig for some 4 or 5 years without...
In solitary confinement.
In very bad conditions, yeah. Tortured, etc. Finally, as the case approached the Supreme Court to say, how can you do this to an American citizen? Let's all remember this guy's an American citizen. I thought, I don't think you should do it to anybody, but the guy's here, he's an American citizen, and they're holding him as a, quote, enemy combatant under Bush. As it gets near the Supreme Court, they decide, well, we may lose this case, or the Bush administration decides it may lose. And they said, okay, why don't we just charge this guy, take him to Miami, put him on trial, and that's what happened. So he did 5 years, I think, in this horrible conditions at Quantico, then tried, then convicted, and then sentenced. Heidi, what happens next?
Well, let's remind listeners, Padilla is now 41 years old. As you say, he was a U.S. citizen. He was convicted in 2007, along with two others, of terrorism support and conspiracy charges. He was sentenced by U.S. District Judge Marsha Cook, and she gave him 17 years, which prosecutors, of course, said was far too lenient for what they called a trained al-Qaeda soldier and former violent gang member. And I think it's worth noting that the judge came to this sentence by giving Padilla some time off for good behavior, and according to the sentencing guidelines, she factored in discounts, which all totaled about 12 years below the 30-year minimum for his particular convictions. Now what's happened is a hearing was held on September 5th to set a new sentencing date for Padilla. That sentencing date is going to be December 3rd. Prosecutors had previously sought the maximum life sentence for him, but now they haven't announced whether they're going to seek that again. I think what we have is similar to the Lynn Stewart case. Listeners will remember Judge Codal gave Lynn what prosecutors said was a far too lenient sentence. They pressured Codal, and then he increased his sentence from about 2.5 years to 10 years. What we have here is prosecutors clearly unhappy with what they consider a lenient sentence, and it will be interesting to see what happens when he is resentenced in early December.
In some ways, it's just so disgusting to me, because I remember I clerked for a federal judge years ago, and for many years, whatever a federal judge decided on sentence was really sacrosanct, particularly from the prosecutor. Yes, occasionally a defendant appealed and said, I deserved a less sentence, but prosecutors really couldn't appeal to get a longer sentence. And the reason for that was really, it was looked at as almost like, that's what the jury decided, that's what the judge decided as final. But in addition, the federal judge sitting there knows the most about the defendant, knows the most from the probation report, knows the most from having watched the trial, knows the most from having seen the defendant in the case, seen the lawyers, etc. So what's happened, really, since these new sentencing guidelines, which have all these numbers in it for what people are supposed to get and have really stultified the system of sentencing to not allow very much discretion on behalf of the judge for the humanity of the defendant in front of them, is the Court of Appeals is sitting here willy-nilly, but not willy-nilly. I would say every sentence that they've reversed has probably been in favor of giving the defendant a heavier sentence. So what they're really, I mean, we might as well call the Court of Appeals the Court of Torquemada. That's what they're doing.
I think noteworthy that Padilla was arrested exactly 10 years ago at O'Hare International Airport in Chicago. Authorities said what he was engaged in was an al-Qaeda mission to detonate a radioactive dirty bomb in a major U.S. city. Recall, this was the very tense post-9/11 atmosphere. And as we are seeing in many cases, the plot was really not much more than a loosely conceived idea. The allegation was discarded long before Padilla was added to the existing Miami terrorism support case. So we have all these resources going into exactly what you say, Michael. It's purely political. It's 10 years later. What a waste.
What a waste, especially as I think your point is on the underlying case. They only came up with the underlying case when they realized they couldn't hold him as an enemy combatant any longer and were going to lose. So they throw together this underlying case. But what's really going on here is just a court of appeals that wants to handcuff anybody probably who's a Muslim alleged to be involved in any kind of what they call terrorism.
Thank you.
Heidi, in a story related to 9/11, we've been following the case of Ward Churchill, who was a Boulder professor at Colorado University, who made some comments about 9/11 and those who died in it and lost his job. And there's been some recent rulings in it. He's been trying to get reinstated. What's the latest news on Ward Churchill?
Michael, listeners may recall that Ward Churchill wrote a controversial essay after 9/11. Actually, it took several years for the university, I think, to even become aware of it. What happened was, 3 or 4 years after the publication of the essay, the Board of Regents launched an investigation into the scholarly body of work of Professor Churchill, alleging that some things might have been plagiarized, basically firing him. A jury found that the termination, was in retaliation for the essay that he wrote. Essentially, he was punished for the content of his speech.
And not for other claims that somehow his academic articles were either some of the language was taken from somewhere else or plagiarism or something else. They found that that was essentially an excuse for firing him, that they really fired him for his political opinions.
Which is why in 2009, the jury awarded Churchill $1 in damages, which is what I believe he asked for. It was a symbolic dollar. We see this happening in cases a lot. Prove your point. What happened after was that Ward took his case back to court to seek reinstatement at the university. A couple of weeks ago, the judge's rejection of Ward's request for reinstatement was basically endorsed at the state of Colorado Supreme Court level. The Supremes there determined that the Board of Regents acted as a quasi-judicial panel. Therefore, they were exempt from Churchill's lawsuit. What this means is that regents can act in a way that immunizes them from such lawsuits. And we think this is a bad decision because it paves the road in the future for other boards of regents to basically terminate someone if they want, and acting in this weird kind of half-judicial body themselves, which really they're not.
No, I think that's really important what you're pointing out. I think the two points are, one is the jury already found that it was a pretext, that he was actually being fired because of his political opinion. And secondly, which affects everybody very broadly, is that a board of regents, a university's ruling powers in many states, can simply dismiss someone, and it's not like a court proceeding, but the court is saying this is like a court proceeding and they can't be sued. I mean, that's remarkable.
And I'd like to read a short quote from Ward's lawyer, David Lane. He said that we had a jury that listened to chapter and verse of this case for a month. They said Ward got fired in retaliation for his free speech. We only asked them for a dollar. They gave us a dollar. We wanted reinstatement. And even though you had a jury saying Ward Churchill is a victim of First Amendment discrimination, a group of judges responded by saying, we're going to rig it so he loses. We're taking the jury's well-thought-out verdict after a month-long trial, throwing it in the trash, simply saying the regents are above the law.
So what's happened to our First Amendment? Well, I guess when it runs into 9/11 and statements that many, many people disagree with and that are even offensive to many, that the First Amendment disappears. Heidi, on occasion, partly because of the politics of what's going on and partly because you are descended from Armenians, at least on one half of you, we follow a lot about what happens with Armenia, both in terms of the failure to declare a genocide in Armenia, the Turks' refusal to recognize when they killed millions of Armenians, I think, when your own family was subjected to that. And now we have another story, and this has to do with Armenia and Azerbaijan. Now, can you first explain, there is a country called Armenia, right?
Yes, there is. For a while, it became a part of the Soviet Union, but it's back to its own nation right now.
And it's near Azerbaijan, or
yes,
within the middle of Azerbaijan? I don't remember the map.
There's land disputes which have created conflict over the years.
Now, it would be underestimating it to say Azerbaijan and Armenia are not particularly close.
Affirmative.
Right. So now we have the latest outrage, and this concerns a murder of an Armenian, of an Armenian man who was in the military in Hungary. Why don't you take it from there, Heidi, and let's see the next outrage from the world with regard to Armenians.
We're talking about an axe murder. Basically, in 2004, a person named Ramil Safarov killed an Armenian officer with an axe. They were both attending a NATO-run military academy in Hungary where they were learning English. 2 years later, Safarov was convicted by a Hungarian court and sentenced to life in prison. But in the end of August, to many people's surprise, Hungarian officials announced that he would be repatriated to Azerbaijan to serve out the remainder of his sentence. But then, upon his return, Safarov received the equivalent of a hero's welcome. He was granted a full pardon by Hungarian President Aliyev when he arrived in Baku, and he was promoted to the rank of major by Defense Minister Safar Abiyev. Now, to add insult to injury, Michael, he was then awarded approximately $57,000 from the military, representing back pay for the years he spent in prison. Now, you can understand, Michael, that Armenia's reaction to this turn of events has been explosive. The president of Armenia immediately suspended diplomatic ties with Hungary and accused that country essentially of betraying justice.
Well, it's remarkable. Here's a guy convicted in Hungary of axe murdering an Armenian. He serves a short sentence. He then gets sent back to Azerbaijan and is given his back pay. I mean, he might have wanted to stay in jail longer so he could get more back pay. Now, I presume he's not in jail in Azerbaijan. It would shock me if he were.
It's interesting, Michael. For years, Armenians in the United States have been pressuring the government here to at least acknowledge in the textbooks that there was a massacre, and the focus of our attention has been Turkey. Now we have Hungary, a totally different country who's joining into what we find highly insulting actions.
We're joined now by Shane Katterdahl, an attorney and head of the Guantanamo team at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He will talk to us about a recently declassified report regarding alleged drugging of detainees. He will also give us a brief report on efforts to get the Bradley Manning court documents.
Shane, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Eddie.
What's this about Department of Defense declassifying a report on alleged drugging of detainees?
Sure. So the Defense Department released Inspector General's kind of internal watchdog report about allegations that detainees had made that the government had had used drugs, things like truth serums, to facilitate interrogations.
This is at Guantanamo or other places as
at
well?
At Guantanamo, yeah. Well, yeah, actually, sorry to be a little bit larger than that. Basically, anybody who was in Defense Department custody. So, you know, that includes Guantanamo. It also includes Jose Padilla inside the United States. He was held as an enemy combatant for most of the time before his trial by DOD. It doesn't include CIA facilities. You know, what the Inspector General's report said, you know, what they want the headline to be basically is that there was no evidence to substantiate allegations that truth serums and other similar drugs were used intentionally in interrogations. But what we think the real headline items in the report are is that it confirms the Defense Department interrogated people who were suffering from serious mental health conditions at the time or who were being treated for psychosis with drugs that were, you know, as powerful as Haldol and other drugs that, you know, are sometimes referred to as kind of chemical lobotomy drugs.
Explain that a bit.
Sure. Well, Haldol is kind of drug that really leaves people in sort of a stupor. It can leave some permanent psychological damage in some instances when it's used. It's just a very, very, very powerful psychoactive drug. And while the Inspector General found that there was no evidence to, you know, conclude, you know, conclusively that that drugs were used intentionally as part of interrogations, what they did confirm was that people had been interrogated while they were under the influence of these heavily sedating, you know, drugs like Haldol, and also that people who were suffering from serious mental health conditions and in some cases being treated with powerful drugs for those conditions were nonetheless interrogated. So I think it's, you know, it's further proof the military was interrogating people who were in no condition to speak the truth about anything. And yet they still went ahead and did it. It really underscores the brutality of the whole system there, and the idea that the interrogations that took place there were centered on getting detainees to talk and to give answers the military wanted by any means necessary rather than on getting to the truth.
Shane, I thought I read years ago that it was kind of a myth about truth drugs, that they didn't really have the effect of having people talk against their will. Do you know anything about that?
Oh, well, sure. One of the interesting things that was revealed in the report was that Jose Padilla was given, I think, something like a flu shot and then told that it was a truth serum. And then interrogated and then asked about it later, and later on an interrogator said, well, there's no such thing as a truth serum. That's more or less true. There is no such thing as a truth serum. There are a lot of drugs that kind of, you know, lower people's
resistance,
degree of conscious control, but there isn't anything that's been proved to sort of make people speak the truth more often than not. There are things that, you know, like alcohol will just kind of, you know, lower one's inhibitions or give one less control over one's faculties. It doesn't mean that what comes out of your mouth is regularly going to be, you know, more accurate, more factually, you know, true than, you know, what you say when you're sober, basically.
We're talking with Shane Catterall about recent disclosures regarding drugs given to people at Guantanamo and others in Defense Department custody over the last years. Shane, when you said the conclusion of the report is that the drugging wasn't given intentionally, which is to say, you know, someone didn't say, let's drug this guy so we can interrogate him, that to me only answers a little bit of it, and I think you've implicated that. You sort of said that, because what they did is they found people who they claim needed drugs in some way, and then they would give them the drugs ostensibly for purposes of helping whatever their mental condition was or something else, and then they would interrogate them afterwards. So it could have been set up really as a pretext for really drugging people to interrogate, but using their medical condition as a means of getting into that without doing it directly. Am I pushing this report farther than it should go?
I think that's accurate. It's, you know, astonishing that somehow the Defense Department now views it as a good thing that they were only, you know, sort of interrogating. They just happened to be interrogating people who were suffering from psychosis and being treated with powerful drugs like Haldol, rather than doing that intentionally in order to, you know, sort of lower their defenses by giving them those same drugs. I think the whole reason we're having this kind of debate, or maybe the whole reason the Defense Department might think that this is a, you know, a good thing that a report like this gets released publicly, is that the Pentagon's kind of interrogation working group under the Bush administration had actually recommended that drugs like truth serums, you know, sodium pentothal, things that have the effects that I mentioned before, you know, not prove to produce the truth, but do kind of, you know, drug up and lower the defenses of individuals, that it would be a good thing to use those. So the working group that, you know, the Bush administration had assembled in order to kind of come up with potentially more legally acceptable, humane kind of methods a few years into the post-9/11 era, that had recommended that these things might be accepted. And in fact, OLC had written a memo saying essentially that as long as it, you know, techniques didn't profoundly disrupt the senses or the personality, that they would be okay. In some sense, it's because the administration thought it was legally acceptable to do this kind of thing that it becomes headline news that, in fact, it wasn't done intentionally. Though, again, I think you're correct to say that, you know, if they interrogate someone knowing that that person is suffering from psychosis and under the influence of powerful psychoactive drugs, it's hard to imagine what really the significant difference is.
So it's really a revelation, really, as you said, about the brutality that took place as a means of interrogating people originally. I mean, from the allegations of cruel and inhuman treatment.
Yeah, and that the interrogations that took place there aren't really trustworthy, which is, you know, it's interesting that it comes out now, the stuff, because a few weeks ago the Supreme Court denied review in a case called Lateef, where there was one item of evidence against a Guantanamo detainee, a particular intelligence report, and the question was, you know, is that report actually an accurate transcription of what happened in an interrogation? You know, essentially the Court of Appeals said that you've got to presume the accuracy of the statements in any intelligence document. So apply that to some of these situations that the Inspector General, you know, confirmed have been happening. You know, a detainee is interrogated while they're on Haldol and suffering from psychosis, and they give some sort of statement. Now the burden is on the detainee to disprove the accuracy, the presumptive accuracy of that statement. And, you know, keep in mind the military has been very good at resisting attempts to get medical records or records of, you know, drug administration to detainees. We have had to fight tooth and nail, and very frequently we've been unsuccessful. now under the case law in the D.C. Circuit, which the Supreme Court has declined to review, all those statements are presumed accurate. And so, folks like Lateef, where there's only one item of evidence against them, a statement, may not be able to find anything to disprove that interrogation document, given the kind of shoddy medical records that were kept at Gitmo and the fact that the military is often successful in fighting to keep those medical records out of court.
You've been at the center for really almost since the beginning of the Guantanamo cases. Here we are going on, 11 years or so. Who's left at Guantanamo, and what's your prediction about whether we're going to get that place closed?
Well, first of all, I think, given the pressures that have led Obama to kind of, fail to keep his promise to close the place during the campaign, which I think essentially are that the administration thinks the American public views the post-9/11 era as largely a success because there hasn't been a similar attack in the U.S., and therefore there's a tremendous incentive to keep the status quo, to not change any of the Bush administration's counterterrorism policies in any way, because if there is another attack, you'll be blamed for somehow facilitating it by making that change. That tremendous kind of incentive, incentive to keep the status quo in place means that, in the second Obama term, we probably won't see anything different. And I think Romney, in the last election, was probably the most gung-ho about keeping the Guantanamo system open. He said during the primaries in 08 that we needed to double Guantanamo, that we needed to send more people there. So I don't really see it changing in the short term. In terms of who's there, it's still remarkable that more than half of the detainees who are left, 169 or however many it is right now, more than half of them are cleared for release. So there's still an awful lot of these kind of, horrendous cases of people, picked up, wrongly sold by warlords or bounty hunters or corrupt Pakistani police to the United States and then detained basically because of the inertia that, fights against any sort of, marginal progress towards closing the place.
Shane, and on those individuals cleared for release, is the fact that they're still there because they don't have a country to go to, or is it just administrative backlog?
I think it's largely the kind of political, backlash that attends any kind of releases from Guantanamo. We see routinely false stories like, this idea that the Bulgarian bus bomber, guy who blew up a bunch of Israeli tourists going to a beach holiday, was a Guantanamo detainee that had been released to Sweden. It turned out to be completely false. But we see this kind of narrative out there, and, I think it probably scares Obama's political advisors. None of us really expect to see any of these cleared detainees released before the election just for that reason, because it becomes another opportunity for Guantanamo to hit the news and therefore for, conservative members of Congress to attack the president.
I want to just get a brief update from you on your work in the Bradley Manning case and your latest set of papers and what's happened quickly in that and then where you are now on trying to get what are public documents in the Bradley Manning case.
Sure. Well, none of the documents have been released in that case, none of the transcripts, none of the government's briefs, none of the court's own orders, which is pretty remarkable given the kind of extensive case law from the Supreme Court that says that the First Amendment guarantees the public and the press a right of access to what's going on in courtrooms. We fought at the trial court in the spring to try to get access to these documents, and the court denied our requests, so we went up to the First Court of Appeals, the Army Court of Criminal Appeals, briefed the whole issue. We were kind of hopeful that they were interested in this issue, and then they issued a one-sentence order denying our claims. So now we've briefed the case fully to the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, which is a much more substantial court. It has civilian judges who are appointed for 15-year terms. It's got a good reputation on First Amendment issues. The case has been fully briefed for about a week or two. We haven't heard anything back from them, but we're kind of hoping that we'll at least get an oral argument and, that maybe we'll actually manage to win and get access to all these documents before the trial actually starts, which is, I think, scheduled now probably for post-election, probably around January. None of those documents have been released so far, so we're hoping that the press and public will get a chance to look at them before Manning actually goes on trial.
Thank you, Shane, and I know you're moving out of the city for a little while, but you'll still be working with CCR on everything from Guantanamo to Manning, so we really appreciate your being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, guys.
Good luck, Shane. Thanks.
Thanks.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Thank you.
Last week, a prisoner held at Guantanamo Bay Naval Station since 2002 died. Adnan Latif was a 35-year-old man from Yemen. He'd been cleared for release by both the Bush administration as well as the Obama administration. He'd even won a court order for his release, but after that order was appealed by the Obama administration, it was overturned. Latif is the ninth prisoner to die at Guantanamo Bay. Today we are joined by one of his attorneys, David Reams. David Reams is a human rights lawyer who has been deeply involved in the litigation on behalf of Guantanamo prisoners since 2004. He represents 16 Yemenis, has been to Guantanamo scores of times for hundreds of days. He has made several visits to Yemen to press for his client's release. He was among the first lawyers to visit Guantanamo after the Supreme Court ruled in Razul v. Bush in 2004 that prisoners had the right to legal counsel. David, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
So, David, let's start with really what I consider to be the most devastating news, and for you personally, I know it was devastating, the death at Guantanamo of Adnan Latif. Can you tell us, when did you first hear about it, and what was your reaction when you heard it?
A government lawyer contacted a couple of colleagues of mine on Tuesday morning, said he had died. We were shocked, obviously. We began to figure out what we should do, and we decided to put out a statement by the lawyers. The team consists of me, Mark Falkoff of Northern Illinois University Law School, who was in it at the very beginning, and some lawyers at Covington and Burling, which really stepped up to the plate after I left in 2008. So we worked on the statement, and I think that was most of Monday. It's kind of a blur. We wanted to call his family, but the government's lawyer said, no, let the ICRC do it. So we waited patiently. As I say, the day was sort of a blur. So I also asked one of the government lawyers, release me to tell the world that the Obama administration had cleared Adnan for release in 2009. Because we're supposed to treat that information as secret information, bizarrely enough, which
Amazing.
Makes it very hard to campaign for the release of individuals and work with foreign governments. Wells Dixon has been involved, of CCR, has been involved in that effort for longer than I'm sure he cares to remember. As for the lawsuit, Adnan, like scores of other detainees, filed habeas corpus petitions in 2004. Some of them also filed in 2005. Habeas corpus petitions, of course, are like lawsuits that demand that the government justify holding you as being legal, that they have a right under the law to hold you. And if they can't justify it, then you have to be freed. That's what a habeas corpus case is. So the year sort of ground on while the Bush administration stalled the litigation and Congress kept trying to strip the detainees of their habeas corpus rights. But in the summer of 2008, the U.S. Supreme Court held in a case called Boumediene, the detainees had a constitutional right to have habeas corpus cases. So at that point, all the cases began to move forward as individual cases, and Adnan's was among them. He was one of our original detainees. And just as a sidelight, Michael, my colleague Mark Falkoff called CCR up right after Boumediene and said, can we represent some detainees? And CCR said, okay, you take these 13 Yemenis. And that's how we got our foot
Amazing.
In the door.
I didn't know that, David.
Well, it's because CCR and Reprieve had collected family authorizations. So that's why they were in a position to do this. They also allocated bunches of cases to other big firms like Paul Weiss and Allen and Overy. So we weren't the only lucky ones.
Lucky ones?
Well, speaking of luck, and this is the side note, Mark came to me and asked if I'd be the supervising partner. And I said to him, well, you know, I'm very busy. I'll be the supervising partner, but only if I don't have to do any of the work. And we see how that turned out also.
So, David, what happened in the habeas case when you filed it?
I'm sorry. He won his habeas case. The whole case against him hinged on a single intelligence report that the district court judge said was unreliable and couldn't be accepted. The government appealed the case to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals reversed, saying that the district court judge should have assumed the document was reliable and credible, and that unless the detainee could prove that it wasn't, he's stuck with the document.
Now, David, this appeals decision was an appeal by the Obama administration, I gather, and it was an appeal in the face of a task force that said he should have been released, right, or transferred.
Yes. There's something really, I don't know if schizophrenic is the right word, but maybe bipolar is a better word. At the same time that U.S. diplomats were trying to relocate detainees, the Justice Department was trying to argue in court that they should remain imprisoned. And nobody can understand that. There are fine distinctions that can be drawn, but at the end of the day, it just sounds like it makes no sense at all.
And then you went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court did what with Lateef?
The Supreme Court denied review. The D.C. Circuit decision was widely viewed as a travesty. I don't know of anyone that came to the defense of the ruling, and we thought it was the best chance for Supreme Court review in a detainee case, but it appears that the Supreme Court has washed its hands of the Guantanamo cases and has just moved on to other things. It's really, really a shame.
David, for our listeners' sake, let's talk a bit about Lateef. He was only 32 years old, and I understand that he had a few suicide attempts and perhaps mentally was not doing that well. What's the last contact that you had with him? What were your visits like? What was he like as a person?
He was a very sweet man. He was small. He was thin. He was sensitive. He was a very, very fine poet. And he felt everything very keenly, perhaps more keenly than any of the other detainees. He felt that his spirit was being crushed, that he was always being roughed up by the guards and the emergency response force, or whatever it was called. He was on long hunger strikes. He was held in isolation for the majority of his time at Guantanamo. He was mentally very, very fragile. He did make suicide attempts. He said that any opportunity that presented itself to him, he'd try to commit suicide. At one point in my representation of him in 2009, he slit his wrists as I was speaking with him. He slit his wrists by chipping off some formica from under the table and cutting into his veins, let the blood drip into a little cup, and then threw his blood on me at the end of the meeting. And I was shocked, but I wasn't angry. I was so sad, and I couldn't understand it. I said, "Why did you do it? Why did you do it?" And he said, "It's not against you. It's not against you." There were some aspects of his condition, mental condition, psychological condition, that I'd just rather not go into. When I went to visit him, I always took an inventory at the very beginning of the meeting, from his head to his toes, of his various bumps, scratches, bruises, swellings, and so forth. It was almost like a doctor's visit, because I wanted to report these things to the world, and I just made these organized lists. He was a small guy. I think that he was sort of a hard guy an easy guy to beat up if you wanted to. He could be very lucid. He was very intelligent. He could think his way through problems. He provided us, after all, with the account of his head injuries and in the 90s and the journey that set him on that wound him up in Afghanistan. He was quite lucid, but then there were other times when he sort of drifted off.
David, Lateef was the ninth inmate to die at Guantanamo. What kind of report does the government give after such a death?
First, there is an autopsy performed, and that's been completed because his remains have been shipped back to Yemen, and the military considers the results of the autopsy and then announces its judgment. There's also automatically a review of the death by the NCIS, the Naval Criminal Investigation Service. That investigation becomes very political because you know that NCIS is never going to reach conclusions that the military was in any way responsible for what happened or had any involvement in what happened. It just won't happen. You just have to question the credibility of the NCIS reports from the very beginning. There was an NCIS report on the deaths of three detainees back in 2009 who were written about by a fine journalist named Scott Horton, who suggested that they had actually been murdered. The NCIS came back with a report. There was an FOIA request. We saw the report, and Mark Denbo at Seton Hall and Scott just ripped it to shreds. And then with respect to the controversial death of very revered figure there named al-Hanashi, they began their review. Oh, let me point out, with those three detainees, the report wasn't completed for a year. With respect to al-Hanashi, who died over a year ago, maybe more, probably more, they haven't come out with a report at all. You really don't know. Human Rights First has called for an independent investigation by someone with no axe to grind from outside. The CCR has called for that, and it's the obvious logical thing to do, but the military is afraid of what it might turn up.
David, you've said a lot that's been very moving since Latif's death. You did talk about where you thought the responsibility for his death lies, no matter what actually were the events that may have that led to the death. Can you just tell us what you said in that?
Whatever the conclusions that are announced, the fact is that it was Guantanamo that killed Adnan. It ruined his health. It ruined his spirit. It may have led him to suicide. It may have weakened him so much that he couldn't survive. He was beat up all the time. It was the entire system of detention that the U.S. has operated in Guantanamo. He was there for 10 years. Apart from his wife, apart from his son, apart from everything he knew, and his personality couldn't withstand the pressures that that imposed upon a person. And therefore, I hold the system of detention that the U.S. has operated in Guantanamo directly responsible for Adnan's death.
Well, David, I just didn't tell you how moved we've been over your not just your work on these cases, but your reaction to Adnan's death. I want to ask you now about something that also happened recently, and of course, as our listeners know, Guantanamo is still open. As the papers reported this, and sort of it seemed like a gross thing to me at the end of a couple of the articles that had actually quoted you. They said, well, now instead of 168 people at Guantanamo, there's 167, which just had this disturbing quality for me, as the only way this place is going to close is the way Adnan...
Adnan said the only way he would leave would be in a casket. Unfortunately, he was right.
Yeah. But David, you did have a victory recently. I know you're always in there fighting. I want to get us to that, which is that you've been representing Guantanamo detainees for a very long time, almost since the beginning. And recently they tried to add additional restrictions or do something with regard to the right of counsel for Guantanamo detainees. And you were outraged by it. You went into court. And why don't you just give us a little bit about what happened in that case?
All right. Well, since 2004, the detainee lawyers and the government have operated within the framework of a protective order, which is issued in many, many cases. It really controls how information gets released, what information gets released, what procedures are in place for the parties to use in the case. So back in 2004, after the Supreme Court said the detainees could go out and pursue habeas, which, as I said, was challenged and spent 4 years on before it became real. In 2004, after this decision called Rasool, the government came into court and said, okay, well, you can hear their cases, but they're not entitled to lawyers. The judge, the district court judge, sort of smacked them down on that. And then, because the case ostensibly involved national security information and classified information, the judge, in good faith, believing that, and maybe it's true in some respects, but anyway, she entered a protective order that allows us to do A, B, C, D, E, F, G in the litigation. And I'll get back to that very quickly. Recently, the government said, okay, we have that protective order, but it no longer applies after a detainee has lost his case or when the detainee doesn't have a case that's active. And in those cases, the commander of Guantanamo, not the court, gets to decide what procedure should be in place and whether or not lawyers could even visit their clients. So, for example, they could set all the terms of our visits. They could say, your visit's going to be 10 minutes. When you spent all that time getting down to Guantanamo, they could say, this is the last thing on our list. It's the lowest priority. We're going to put everything ahead of it, whether it's the military commissions or the lunchtime schedule of our troops. And it just gave absolute unlimited power to the commander. And you would find, as time goes on, that decisions in habeas cases will become final, or people will withdraw their cases. And at that point, the protective order ceases to apply. And under the government's rules, we'd have to ask the government if we could look at our own files from the habeas cases. We wouldn't be able to share the information in our files with other habeas counsel, even though it might be directly pertinent to their cases. There are a whole bunch of restrictions like that. I was kept from seeing one client in May who had reached this point, and two clients I was prevented from seeing in August in the schedule, unless I signed this new document called the Memorandum of Understanding. I wouldn't do it. I just wouldn't play along with this.
No, I thought it was great. That was amazing that she just refused. And, David, I want to push you forward on this story a little bit.
We went to
court, right?
We went to court. Judge Lamberth, who is a conservative Law and Order Reagan appointee, he's fair and he follows the law and so forth, but he's not known as a raging liberal. He was offended. He said to the government, you know what this is about? It's about whether you're in charge or I'm in charge.
Wow.
And he went down the list and said, this is nothing like the protective order. The detainees' lawyers can't possibly do their jobs. And I'm striking down this new memorandum of understanding and saying that the old protective order, the existing protective order, which has worked for 8 years without trouble, applies to everything.
Yeah, it was a big victory. It was carried all over. This is one of your main clients. It was the main Supreme Court case. I mean, how are you dealing with it?
The one good thing that comes out of it is that it has brought Guantanamo and the injustice of Guantanamo and the U.S. policies there back to people's consciousness. I don't know how long that will last, but Guantanamo had just become a forgotten issue. I once called a Washington Post reporter up and told him that a detainee had died and asked him to write a story about it, and he said that his editors told him, we've already done the dead detainee story. And that's the way the media works. So this really got the issue back in front. I think there'll be further media on the question of how he died, and there are other things that are probably going to bubble up. And from that standpoint, I think it's very positive because it reinvigorates the issue, and we just have to keep the fire boiling.
Yeah, well, it's boiling at all, David, is a lot because of your stick-to-itiveness. Is my last question, how many times have you been to Guantanamo, David?
Dozens of times.
Dozens. You can't even count them, right?
I haven't kept count. And I'd like to add, if I may, that these aren't down there one day or 2 days and back. I have 17 clients. So all of my trips are 5 or 6 days, 8 or 9 days, with travel on either end. And you haven't lived until you have spent that long in Guantanamo on a barren side of the bay and with all of the tension and grimness of being there.
David Reams, thank you very much for this and for really being there for Latif and for the other people at Guantanamo.
Thank you very much.
Bye, David.
Adnan Latif, the Guantanamo detainee who died last week, was a poet. A few years ago, one of his poems appeared in a book called Poems from Guantanamo, The Detainees Speak. Heidi, I'd like you to read this poem.
They are criminals, increasing their crimes. They are criminals, claiming to be peace-loving. They are criminals, torturing the hunger strikers. They are artists of torture. They are artists of pain and fatigue. They are artists of insults and humiliation. They are faithless, traitors and cowards. They have surpassed devils with their criminal acts. They do not respect the law. They do not respect men. They do not spare the elderly. They do not spare the baby-toothed child. They leave us in prisons for years, uncharged, because we are Muslims. Where is the world to save us from torture? Where is the world to save us from the fire and sadness? Where is the world to save the hunger strikers? But we are content on the side of justice and right, worshiping the Almighty. And our motto on this island is Salam.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.